Hi, Bill Kristol here. I'm joined by the inimitable Mona Charon, policy editor of The Bulwark, longtime friend and writer of so many important things, and with her own podcast, which you all should be listening to, of course, as well. Charlie Sykes has the day off. He got his second shot yesterday, which is good news, but had a little bit of a reaction, which I guess is pretty common and is not so much of a reaction that he couldn't write an excellent newsletter this morning. I noticed that he seems to have bugged out of podcast duties. So Mona and I are pinch hitting. How are you, Mona?
I'm great. You know what I learned in the last few months, Bill, that I never knew before?
What's that?
Which is that the British have a different expression. They call it a jab, not a shot. And
yes,
it makes a lot more sense, don't you think? I mean, shot, it sounds like, you know, something about guns or, you know, whereas jab really captures what happens, right?
Yeah, the British slang is really kind of fantastic because it weirdly combines often, I think. The jab is a good instance of this. It's both more, I don't know, informal is not quite the right word, but as you say, what's the word I'm looking for? Colorful, maybe, than American slang.
Yeah.
But then it's also kind of more literary at times. I don't know. It's funny. I watch a lot of these British, police shows and detective shows.
Me too.
Really, yeah. That one of the fun things is listening to the different expressions, and they're different, of course, within Britain. I mean, this is something I never really appreciated until I started. What I know a fair amount about Great Britain, but how much the regional differences of accent and expression within Britain, which is kind of a small country. I mean, but it's
I know, and this is something I too, you know, I'm a complete fanatic about British shows of various kinds, and so I've gotten an education about the regional accents too, a little bit. And therefore, it was kind of funny when, during the first Trump impeachment, Fiona Hill became a great star, which she deserves completely. But it was interesting to see the American reaction, because from the American point of view, she had a British accent, and that was all they could hear. But from her point of view, when she was telling her story, she has a Northern accent, right? And that accent is looked down upon by people in London and elsewhere, and Oxford and Cambridge and so forth. And so she mentioned that having this accent was actually a disadvantage to advancement in Britain. And Americans just were saying, oh, she's so hoity-toity with that accent.
Right. Yeah, now the Northern accent, I mean, yeah, in Britain, it was once a big thing, maybe less so, I assume less so, much less so now. Yes, if you wanted to make it, you had to adopt a kind of public school Oxford Etonian accent or whatever.
Right.
Public school being private boarding school in Britain, yet another of the terms that's different there. And I think people who, you know, wrote memoirs early in the last century often talked about this, I think, and or not abandoning their accent and feeling slightly.
Right. And if you don't mind going down a tiny further tangent, sorry, I'm really
obsessed
by this.
No, this is a good tangent, I think. Yeah.
But I think this is true. Somebody can double check me. But you know how the aristocrats in Britain used ain't and so forth in like the 18th century?
Right.
I read that the reason for that was that they were being raised by nannies who were lower class and they hardly ever saw their parents and they just adopted it.
Oh, that's interesting. That's interesting. Yeah. I thought you were going to say something, which I've read also, and I'm not sure it's true, that somehow some of what we regard as, I don't know, like working class or slang, like ain't, is actually aristocratic and vice versa.
It became so after the nannies introduced it to the aristocratic kids in the 18th century, and then it sort of became a thing.
Yeah, I think the middle class, I guess this is a famous article in the 50s, is it Jessica Mitford or someone? The middle class was sort of more concerned to be proper and precise in pronunciation and grammatical.
Yes.
Than the upper class. Part of being a true aristocrat is that you ignore all these rules that are really for the bourgeoisie, right?
Exactly. You don't have to prove anything. Yeah.
So since we're on the topic, we're a minute on British crime and procedural shows. Not sure we actually had this discussion. So which is your favorite, or which two or three would you recommend to our listeners? Because we're doing a real service. This is more of a public service. With all due respect to Charlie, all this talk about politics is nice, but this is a real service if we can recommend some excellent Netflix.
Yes. But the thing is, I'm going to forget their names. There was one about, maybe Jim Swift will know it. It was a seaside town, not Bridgewater,
but Broadchurch?
Broadchurch.
I'm so behind. I'm now watching all these shows. My wife Susan makes fun of me. All these shows that were popular, you know, 5-7 years ago.
But right. Well, I do the same thing. Yeah.
Broadchurch is really excellent, I've got to say.
Yes.
Yeah. Hinterland, have you seen that one? That's also
no.
That's gloomier. I think Northern England, sort of very good regional accent. But I think it was on around the same time as Broadchurch. Very similar, I would say, kind of the moody detective.
I do watch pretty much as many British shows as I possibly can, you know. So, you know, not just the police procedurals, but, you know, all of them, you know, Downton Abbey and the rest, that was pretty silly, but it was still entertaining.
There's a good Australian show I recommend, Janet King. There were three series of it. She's a detective and it's kind of a little bit more courtroom scenes, that kind of thing.
Yeah. But, yeah.
Sort of interesting to see how the Australian system works and well done and sort of very, you know, gripping and I guess 3 seasons, but again, like the British shows or like American shows, I guess too. Now it builds up, you know, it's this sort of a contained plot for each episode or every 2 episodes, but it also builds upon itself. And so you're supposed to watch the whole thing.
I'm in awe of these writers for keeping the tension going. It's amazing.
Yeah, no,
they can keep you interested.
This is such an irony. Paul Cantor makes this point, and actually I did a couple of conversations with him about this that people can watch and listen to on Conversations with Bill Kristol. Paul teaches English literature, Shakespeare originally at UVA, but also pop culture. And I mean, he early on saw how high quality TV was becoming, and the utter transformation from TV in our generation is the lowest prestige, you know,
right,
medium to really the best, maybe, I guess, in terms of visual entertainment. I mean, you know, and partly because of, I guess, the change in the business model or of cable, which allowed you to have 10 hours of a plot instead of, you know, 22 minutes or 45 minutes or whatever the real length of an hour series is.
Right. Absolutely. Really, yeah. And I know that listeners will probably, you know, roll their eyes, but I am with Sarah in praising The French Village, which is one of the best things I've ever seen.
Yeah, we have resisted that because it's like 165 episodes or something.
It's a lot of episodes. Yes, it's a lot of episodes, but it's one of the finest things I've ever seen on television, I have to say.
Is that right? Okay. My teacher, Harvey Mansfield, likes it very much, and it's also a good way to practice your French, I guess, if you don't want to just depend on the subtitles. So
with the subtitles,
maybe the best way, because you can then check that you're actually understanding what they're saying. How is it? It's set. I mean, it's in Vichy, France, or in Nazi?
It's in a village. In a village that's right on the border between occupied France and Vichy France.
Right.
And there's a river that's the border. And it's just this fantastically interesting exploration of how people cope with the compromises and the necessities. It does have a lot of current relevance. And as some of us have said, you could certainly understand people who felt the need to collaborate when the alternative was having your life endangered and certainly your livelihood endangered. In our time, if it just means getting some mean tweets or losing your seat, and even still people have no courage, it's less easy to understand.
Well, let's talk about that, I guess, since that's a good segue there. That was very professionally done. You should have your own podcast. You know?
Oh, yeah. Thank you. Beg to differ.
Yes. Listen, who's your guest this week? Do you have someone lined up?
Yeah, Corey Shockey. We're going to discuss the Biden's administration's approach to Iran and the Iran deal and all of that.
Oh, great. No, in front. Yeah. She's a very interesting person, lively. That'll be a good,
yes,
a good show, I'm sure. So that's something else to look forward to this week. So, I mean, we'll get to Cuomo and we'll get to other things, but let's begin with just the obvious, which is the kind of somewhat amazing, I would say, continued captivity of the GOP to Trump after losing, after January 6th after everything, right? It seems not to have diminished at all. What do you think? What do you make of that?
And you know, we have to every now and then pinch ourselves and say that this is so bizarre. It is how many weeks now, 8 weeks or whatever it is, since the insurrection at the Capitol. And if you go back and you remember what people were saying in the immediate aftermath of that horrific thing, you know, everybody, including Kevin McCarthy, the majority leader, the minority leader of the House, and all, everyone was saying this is awful. And, you know, Lindsey Graham said, "I'm out." Tried to be helpful, but this is it. And you know, the Wall Street Journal editorial board was calling for him to be removed and impeached immediately. And National Review said, you know. Anyway, everybody was unanimous that this was finally the thing that had caused the dam to break and everyone to agree that this man was a danger to the country. Fast forward, and now we have, you know, of course, members of Congress who voted to impeach being sanctioned by their local Republican parties in their home states. You have Mitch McConnell voting to voting not to convict, though he made that great speech afterwards. But then he appeared on television a couple weeks later and was asked if Trump were the nominee in 2024. If Trump, the man who you just said endangered the Republic, made war on another branch, basically. Would you support him for re-election? And he said, absolutely. And so, you know, we have to stop and say this is so beyond anything we have ever seen in American life that we have to keep reminding ourselves this is nuts. And this is what I find hard to understand about people who have been in the Republican orbit all of their lives and who have been intellectuals in particular, right, who have seen their role as being to influence the Republican Party and to influence public policy through the Republican Party, who are sort of pretending that things are sort of more or less normal now, when they're anything but normal. You have one party that is completely in the thrall of Trump and Trumpism. And as long as that's the case, that entire party, not just Trump, that party is a threat to the American system. And those people cannot be permitted to wield power.
Yep, I'm totally with you. I mean, I guess they would say some of the ones who are not, you know, simply in denial, but maybe a more complicated form of hopefulness, would say, well, we can return gradually. The Republicans and conservatism can return gradually to normalcy. It's only a month after Trump has left office, 6 months, 12 months from now, it could be different. Let's see what happens in Congress and in 2022 in the primaries. And I mean, obviously we would like it. I mean, I would be very happy. And we're in fact doing things both privately and in terms of encouraging people and certainly in our, you know, other efforts at Defending Democracy Together to help Republicans willing to stand up to Trump. But you just, every time you think, and this is what strikes me so much, every time one has thought, well, okay, finally, you know, they're going to break the spell.
Yeah.
They don't. And I don't know why we think it would happen now. And as JBL keeps on saying, it's the voters. And there's a good piece in the Post today, pretty interesting. It's not quite a representative sample when it's a kind of panel poll, but people, they really went and looked at these political scientists at MAGA Republicans, which is about half of Republicans really at
this
point, and how firmly they support Trump, how entrenched their support is, and how serious it is. I think this is something that the sort of people who wish the party to get beyond Trump don't want to think too hard about, that, you know, well, they've sort of got deluded and they got caught up in the excitement, but the fever will break. You hear that a lot. And I've used that, I'm sure, myself many times, and the bubble will burst. But maybe maybe it is ultimately a fever, but it doesn't seem to be breaking. And in fact, one of the interesting data points in this piece, in this op-ed in the Post, which people can take a look at, is the, you know, it's not, these are people who are pretty well educated, pretty middle class. The Trump supporters are not, you know, as they're not the yahoos that people want to pretend they are. I mean, some are, right, obviously, but and so they sort of weirdly, they know a lot. They have arguments to back up what they're saying. Someone made this point to me. He used to do talk radio. He's not in our circles now, but the other just chatting, catching up personally a week or two ago, that it's a mistake to think of these people as not knowing anything. They actually know a lot because they listen to talk radio. They read things on Facebook. They read, you know, things within their, they watch Fox and OAN. So they have arguments, which actually makes it harder than to dislodge them. If people just didn't know anything, got suckered by some silly, by the president of the United States saying over and over, hoax, 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 then, okay, fine, you could get some information to them and they might say, yeah, gee, I guess it's not a hoax. But they have a lot of, quote, information. It's just very deceptive information. And then when you get into conspiracy-mindedness, the information that seems to cut against them is just part of the conspiracy. So I think people have underestimated, and I would be plead guilty to this too, the difficulty of dislodging people from the kind of the bubble they're now in, or the echo chamber they're now in.
So it does remind you of the Mark Twain quote, which I think is a real quote, which is, it's not what they don't know that's the problem. It's what they know for sure that just ain't so.
Yeah, that's a good one. That is good. I thought of that in this context.
And, yeah. And you know, one of the items in that poll, and again, these are MAGA supporters. This is not a poll, we should stress, of the Republican Party in general. But among the, and it is about 50% of the party, as you say, though. So, and about 70% of these people not only support Trump, not only would love to see him run in 2024, but believe that he should remain in office beyond two terms. 70% said that. So this is an anti, by definition, an anti-democratic, anti-constitutional attitude that they have. And you know, you're absolutely right that, you know, it's the voters and the voters want this. But who influences the voters, right? I mean, they get their information from Fox and from the online websites like the Federalist and the others. I mean, they don't get their information from nowhere. And yes, there's a lot that circulates on Facebook and Twitter and various other, you know, sort of informal ways, but they get legitimacy when those conspiracy theories and so forth are picked up by so-called mainstream outlets that they see on TV. It's not enough to just have it circulate online. It has to be ratified, and it is ratified not just by Fox, although that's bad enough. Tucker Carlson is very influential. Laura Ingraham, all those people. But by Republican politicians and office holders who, again, give it another layer of legitimacy. And, you know, I watched a tiny bit, thank God I didn't have to watch very much, but I watched a tiny bit of the CPAC thing. And there was Mike Lee, right, giving a speech about the Constitution and threats to the constitutional order. And he's giving a talk at CPAC, and what should Mike Lee, who I used to think was a serious person and who tries to portray himself as such, I think he's written three books about the Constitution. His father was the Solicitor General under, I guess, Ford or maybe Reagan.
Yeah, beginning of Reagan, I think.
Reagan, okay. So he has a distinguished pedigree and so forth. And you would, you know, Mike Lee was speaking to a crowd of people who all believe that the election was stolen, and this has undermined their faith in democracy itself, all based on lies. And does he go to CPAC and try to dispel the lies so that we can have a healthier polity? No, he doesn't even address it. It's like it doesn't exist. And so I don't see how you can take someone like Mike Lee seriously as an intellectual, as a lover of the Constitution, or even frankly, Bill, and this is relevant to you and me, even as a conservative, rightly understood, right? Mm-hmm. Because he is not attempting to conserve the very thing, the American founding, the whole system that we all supposedly revere, because you cannot on the one hand, wink and nod about a huge lie that is undermining respect for democracy among one of the major political parties, and claim to care about democracy, legitimacy, the American experiment.
Yeah, I very much agree with that. And the failure of Republican elected officials and conservative, you know, elites to stand up to the big lie and to stand up to Trump and Trumpism has been a huge problem. Even the ones who haven't echoed it, and a lot have, just the failure to, as you say, to confront it when you yep. have a real chance, whether it's writing in the Wall Street Journal or speaking on the floor of the Senate or speaking at CPAC, where you're going to get national attention. That's itself a huge problem. It sort of implicitly suggests, well, it's a little, maybe these views are a little odd or a little off, but they're not a serious problem, but they are a serious problem. Why do you think, I've been struck by, if you had told me 10 years ago, you know, the Republican Party could go in a pretty wacky direction in foreign policy. It could go Buchananite or isolationist. It could go protectionist. Mm-hmm. It could go, some really, you know, flat tax or something like that. Even it could go, it would go very anti-immigration. I wouldn't have liked it. I would have been surprised at how much it might have happened. You know, I wouldn't have thought it would happen, but I would have realized it could happen. Obviously, you could see those strains very visibly. I am a little amazed by the willingness to go just authoritarian, to really go anti-democratic.
Yeah.
So it, both among the elites, but and among the voters, obviously. I mean, the willingness to just take that extra step, and this is why this big lie is somewhat different from the other big lies, right? The other lies. The lies about immigration are damaging and should be refuted. But this is a big lie about the actual political system and constitutional system. And has that surprised you too? I mean, I would have thought there would be more attachment to the constitutional order in some sense or other, and to, you know, the political order that of America against the Trumpist assault.
Especially coming from a political party whose leaders are constantly beating their breasts about being constitutionalists, right? I mean, that was their big selling point. And in fact, that was at least part of the supposed message of the Tea Party, which I now think I vastly overestimated the sincerity of. But they supposedly were, you know, wanting to return to an older version of the constitutional order and so forth, and with their tri-cornered hats and whatnot. The attraction of authoritarianism, I don't know, Bill. I mean, initially I thought maybe it was a kind of a response to Islamic radicalism, which frightened them really badly, frightened a lot of people. That therefore, you know, and one of the things that Trump would say during the campaign, and if you recall, in 2016, we weren't that removed in time from a lot of the outrages of ISIS being on the news, you know, people being burned in cages and beheaded, right, and all the rest of it. And Trump got up there and said, you know, you have to be vicious. You have to be you have to be terribly vicious, and you have to commit war crimes. And people said, yeah, you know, I that's what I want, because I'm scared. But at that moment, I sort of understood it. But now that sort of threat has receded, and we don't really face an external enemy, I'm perplexed. And I'm noting, again, going back to what they talked about at CPAC, that now it almost seems like there is a performative quality to their invocation of foreign threats. So they talked a lot about the dangers from China. And, you know, I have been a hawk about China my entire life. Mm-hmm. China's an evil regime, okay? But the way they were presenting it, it was almost as if they don't have any plans for how to confront China, but they just wanted their audience to feel a sense of threat. And I guess I don't understand it. I guess it's partly, you know, the drumbeat of talk radio and the rest who have found that ratings, you can get better ratings from fear and hatred than anything else. But I'm really at a loss. And I do note that there's a story in the paper today about efforts to improve civics education in the U.S. and maybe that'll help. I don't know.
Yeah, no, I hope, but it's education, but it's not that they don't know that we have three branches of government. That's not really the problem, or that when the Constitutional Convention was, is that they've let the fears and the anxieties overwhelm the attachment, I would say, to the liberal, small L, liberal and conservative constitutional order. And that can happen, obviously, and has happened in history and even in our own history at times, but usually for a short period of time. And again, I do then come back to Trump. And I think this is where people who criticize us, frankly, for, you know, worrying, he's too obsessed with Trump, are just wrong. I mean, when you have a president reinforcing this every day in a demagogic way, the fears, the anxieties, the hatreds, and not reinforcing, to say the least, any reverence for the rule of law, the constitutional order, but quite the opposite, actually just showing, having an attitude of scorn to it. 4 years of that, you know, we all warned that 4 years of this would do damage back in 2015, 2016. And I think it has done a lot of damage. I think therefore these debates about what do we do now? I think it would be great if the Republican Party could frankly come back to the Republican Party of 2014 or 15, or jump forward. Nothing ever goes backwards in history, but jump forward to a new Republican Party that was whatever, had some compromises on policy on certain issues, but was not in this fundamental way Trumpy. I mean, maybe we should stop using the term Trumpy, which makes it too much sound like it's about a person or about an affect or attitude. Mm-hmm. It is about the real authoritarianism.
Authoritarianism, absolutely.
So deep, though. That's so deep. That's what's so distressing and worrisome. And it's why I've argued, you've argued, why you and I supported Joe Biden, voted for him in 2020, because you just couldn't afford four more years of Trump. And I'm afraid, and as you said earlier in the show, and I've said, we hard to see we can really afford, you know, a Republican. We certainly can't afford Trump again in 2024. And I'm not sure the Republican candidate's going to be that much more attractive from our point of view in terms of fundamentals about the rule of law, the constitutional order,
truth,
the system we're in, civility and decency and so forth, than Trump. So, I mean, for now, here we are. And this has caused something of a debate among Never Trumpers. Should we try to help the Biden administration be as good as it can be for now? Should we work with Democrats? Should we just stick with being Republicans? And I wrote a couple of things on this. You've written on this. Jonah Goldberg takes a different point of view. Matt Lewis has a piece today, which is an intelligent, I think, you know, summary in a way of the debate. He's kind of on Jonah's side. And let's talk about that for a minute. I think our listeners might be interested. They can make up their own mind, obviously. And we published, incidentally, on The Bulwark, Joe Walsh saying third party, and I think Christian Vandenbroek, I think, implying more, let's continue to fight within the Republican Party, which, and God knows, we're also interested in continuing. So I think there's a totally respectable diversity of views on this. Practical judgment, really, not a principled one. Not that that's a firm distinction, but it's a practical judgment of the balance of forces and where one can do the most good. And for now, how urgent the situation is, or how much one can sit back and sort of wait for the party to fix itself and stuff. But anyway, I've talked too much. So give me your sense of where that whole debate
you,
is.
You got the whole thing rolling with a really brave and interesting suggestion that we think about, possibly trying to help Biden, and that set off a good rollicking debate, which is great. One of my thoughts, which is that when people say I could never become in any way cooperative or allied with the Democratic Party because I'm devoted to principles, I'd have to say, but where in the Republican Party is the room for principles? Is it hospitable to principles right now at all? I mean, the principles are a joke in the Republican Party. Conservative principles, all principles, constitutional principles, it's a joke. So that's one thing. the other thing is that I would echo something that our colleague and friend Charlie Sykes says, which is, you know, having resigned and left one group, you don't necessarily want to sign up with another. And I understand that, and I agree that you know one's loyalties should be only very reluctantly bestowed, because people will disappoint you, parties will disappoint you. On the other hand, I recall, and this is kind of an interesting perspective, that back during the 2020 campaign, when it became clear that people like Republican Voters Against Trump and other Never Trump people were attempting to help Biden get elected, there were people on the left who said, this is bad. We don't want this, because those people are going to infiltrate the Democratic Party and bring a conservative perspective. And we don't want that perspective in our party. And I'm, you know, when you look at the results of the 2020 race, I think it's undeniable that disillusioned Republicans helped Biden win in significant ways in key states. Had it not been for the defection of Republicans in suburbs in key states, Biden might not be president right now. And, you know, the fact is, it's not crazy to think that if some disillusioned Republicans decide to, at least temporarily or maybe even for longer, become affiliated with the Democratic Party, they might be an important constituency that the Democratic Party would have to grapple with. I'm not saying the Democrats would be great at it. I mean, look at the way they're treating Joe Manchin. You know, some Democrats are really irritated that they have to deal with the likes of Joe Manchin. But when you're a big tent with a lot of different groups, you do have to make accommodations. And arguably, you know, the Democrats would be in much better shape when it comes to winning elections. They wouldn't have to rely on, you know, a few thousand votes in key states if they were a little more moderate on certain questions. And so, you know, it's just an interesting thought experiment to say, maybe, you know, the injection of some former Republicans into the Democratic Party would move the party in a better direction, both for policy and for the Democrats' electoral prospects.
Right. And I would add, and Biden, and the key point for me, I mean, it's not sort of, I think you make a very strong argument there, but it's not as if we're just randomly choosing two parties, like, you know, from a standing start, and which one do we think we can help a little bit more with, which is closer to us. One is, Biden's the president. He'll either succeed or not. The Democrats are in charge right now of both the House and the Senate. So I do feel that sort of ignoring that or just writing that off is really a little crazy and kind of irresponsible, because it kind of matters that he's a better rather than worse president in certain ways. And even if you regard yourself as limiting the damage he does in certain areas, it's important to limit that damage. And so, especially after 4 years of Trump. So I think that, yeah. I think people like us have a sense of urgency about the moment, that people who have a little more relaxed attitude towards kind of, well, I don't like the Trump Republicans, but I don't like the Democrats either. So I'm just kind of sitting it out. I do think you mentioned 2020. For me, that's really the decisive difference, actually, in this little debate among Never Trumpers. The people who aren't where we are, if I could say, the people who are very skeptical of working with the Democrats at all, didn't in fact work with the Democrats in 2020. They didn't vote for Biden over Trump. Matt Lewis, interestingly, voted for Biden, he says, in a primary to try to get a better Democratic nominee, but then in the general election. Fine, I never tell anyone how to vote, but I don't know. Here's my question for Matt Lewis and Jonah, who I assume are at Goldberg, who I assume are loyally listening to this Charlie's podcast here. Do they think that was right? And this is a serious question, not a rhetorical one. Do they think it was the right decision, the right choice, not to choose between Biden and Trump in 2020? Now, of course, I don't know. Jonah lives in D.C., I think, and I don't know where Matt lives, but no one vote matters. I understand all that. It's symbolic. But if you're a voter in Wisconsin or Pennsylvania or something, I just don't see how people can sit here on March 2nd who have the general view of Trump and of authoritarianism and nativist populism and so forth that we have and that Matt and Jonah have, and say, well, it didn't matter. I was right to sit out 2020. That it's not, the country's not better off to have Joe Biden as president for the next 4 years than Donald Trump. That's what they're saying. That's what they said when they refused to choose in 2020. That's what they're saying today by, in effect, carrying forward that refusal to choose. And again, as you say, this is all temporary and no one's signing up for any party forever and, you know, at all. I mean, honestly, I can imagine voting for a Republican in all kinds of elections over the next several years. But as a matter of general attitude, the kind of, the Republican Democrats, they're going to go bad. Even if they're not so bad right now, they're going to get worse. Mm-hmm. Well, is that kind of fatalism warranted? But again, it's the sense of urgency and then the sense of the 2020 and the judgment, I think, of the 2020 choice that brings home the difference for me. But anyway, it's an interesting debate.
Yeah, no, that's
participating in it, I suppose. And
can I just respond to what you said, because I think that's so well put. To frame it as, you know, is it better to sit it out and to say, no, I can't choose between Trump and Biden. They're equally unacceptable outcomes. I mean, that's really what you're saying. And that's a position that I could not possibly take. And I would go a step further and just say that for the sake of the country and the sake of the kind of stability that I think we want, for the nation, I think it's also incredibly important that Biden succeed, right? And I'm not sure how many like never Trump people would say that, but I think if Biden is a failed president, then you have the opportunity for even more kind of radicalism to take hold on the left. And certainly the right is very radical already. And so for the sake of our country's stability, I think it's actually very important that Biden be successful and be perceived to be successful.
No, I think that's well said, and I think it's probably a good thing to end on. We've gone long enough. We've taxed our listeners' patience since we're replacing the irreplaceable Trump.
Exactly, the irreplaceable.
We need to talk about Mario Cuomo. That shows my age.
Andrew
Cuomo and how horrible he is and how bad a lot of the wokeness we're seeing is, but whether that's better fought than by helping old-fashioned liberals, joining with old-fashioned liberals in that fight, or saying, no, we can't even possibly be Democrats because look at Andrew Cuomo. I mean, that's so interesting, and he's so much in the news. Say a word. You followed him. You followed New York politics, and say a word about that, though.
So Andrew Cuomo has had lots of troubles in his career and has been the subject of earlier corruption investigations and so forth. And now he was, before this whole Me Too thing erupted in the last week or two, he was subject of some very, very harsh stories about his handling of the coronavirus. And that's, you know, that's, he should be closely followed. He should be held accountable for whatever bad decisions he has made. But I would just note this, that a number of the people who were most harsh about Cuomo have been his fellow Democrats in the legislature. They've been attempting to pare back some of the power that they gave him to cope with the COVID emergency. Those are Democrats attempting to do this. They are attempting to hold him accountable. Now, maybe not to the degree that one would like or whatever, but I mean, it does stand in stark contrast to the kind of martinets in the Republican Party who just say, whatever the dear leader says, you know, we will snap to attention. So I think that's actually the way things are supposed to work, is that parties are supposed to discipline themselves. And so I think we'll see what happens to Cuomo. It wouldn't surprise me if he were even forced to resign, but we'll see. These days, apparently, the way people handle scandal is just to brazen it out rather than do the Profumo. Speaking of showing your age, right? The Profumo way, which was to retire from politics and devote yourself to charitable work. But in any event, I do note a difference there, that at least some Democrats have been willing to call out Cuomo, and that's to the good.
Yeah, it is to the good. And we can be, I think we can be anti-Trump and anti-Cuomo. And but luckily, Cuomo is not president and didn't run for president. And as you say, a lot of Democrats seem to be willing to call him out. And the broader, there are a lot of other questions that we could discuss and we will discuss. And you've discussed, of course, so many times on your podcast and have written so well about wokeness and how to fight that and how to ally with classical liberals to fight that and also fight conservative versions of wokeness as well as left-wing versions of wokeness. But we will leave that for another time. And so there'll be many other occasions. One good thing about the Bulwark is we can write about these things. We can talk about them on more than one podcast, yours and Charlie's. We can discuss them.
Mine is called Beg to Differ. Sorry to interrupt. Mine is called Beg to Differ. Beg to Differ.
And people need to listen to it. And I think people are listening to it. The numbers are great. And it's really been a great, that and Charlie's podcast have been great. And you also need to watch, if you can, you need to join Bulwark. Well, you shouldn't need to. I shouldn't say that. You should join Bulwark Plus, which gets you all kinds of additional benefits, including the live stream that's now become a regular Thursday night feature of a surprising number of people's lives, I've got to say. But a worthwhile feature, right, Mona?
They're great. It gives us a chance also to interact with our members. And, you know, we're in the chat. Those of us who are not on the live stream in any particular evening, we're usually in the chat talking with our members. So it's fun.
So do join Bulwark Plus. Do join the live stream Thursday night. Do listen to Beg to Differ and Charlie's podcasts and read the Bulwark and all that. And thank you for joining us today. And I believe, unless this little reaction, minor kind of, he said, achiness to the second shot persists, the irreplaceable Charlie Sykes will be returning tomorrow for this podcast.